Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, August 11th. In 2018, at the New York State Democratic Convention, Governor Andrew Cuomo said this.
Sexual harassment of women is real, it is undeniable, and this is the moment in history to make the reform and end it once and for all. And New York is going to be the state to do it. It ends here and it ends now.
Cringeworthy now, maybe, right? But was he being prescient? Is his resignation a sign that Me Too has staying power? To talk about Me Too, Andrew Cuomo, women and power, we're going to put this story into national, maybe even global context. Let's hear from Rebecca Traister, writer-at-large for New York Magazine and author of the book Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. Hi, Rebecca. Welcome back.
Hi, Brian. It's good to be here.
So your focus on Governor Cuomo has been on power and how he uses it, how what you call the theatrics of dominance kept him in power. Can you describe what you mean by theatrics of dominance?
Yeah, there's a thing that Andrew Cuomo is great at, and it is performing authority, right? And we can think of the sort of ways he's done it well, right? Performing competence, like in the news conferences through COVID that won him an Emmy, you know, and that people loved and felt comforted by. He would get up there and he would perform confidence and he was in control. And that's sort of the prettiest version of this, right? It was comforting to a lot of people. Now, what we later learn, and the reason that I emphasize the word performance there, is that in fact, the state was in many ways mismanaging, underreporting the number of deaths in nursing homes. His top aides, as was revealed in a different report that came out of the Attorney General Tish James' office earlier this year, was actually covering up the number of people who were dying. So it was a performance of leadership, but it was often the performance of leadership is understood as leadership, right? And then there were a lot of nastier and far uglier ways in which he did this that were also always on display. And in fact, that have also been sort of weirdly appreciated, cringingly appreciated. You know, he's a famous bully. He's had his top staff members be bullies. Long before this happened, you know, he has some of his top staffers, including his spokesperson, Rich Azzopardi, calling three female members of his own party in the state legislature, I can't use the full phrase, but effing idiots in the newspaper, you know? Mm-hmm. He publicly insults people, including in his own party. As many have alleged over years, he worked hard behind the scenes to actually keep his own party out of power in the state legislature by supporting the conservative IDC that kept the legislature out of Democratic hands. But he does it. When I reported a story on him in March, a long reported piece that I did, I talked to so many people who'd worked for him, like on policy, who all described to me a governor who was obsessed with press conferences, right? Obsessed with being out in front of cameras, getting the photo shoot, doing the theatrics of I'm the leader and I'm here in charge, and paid far less attention to the actual mechanics of how to get policies through. He's not a governor who cares very much about policy. And I think even without that reporting, you could see that that's true. But this is not at odds with how we've been taught to understand power in this country, that if you present yourself as dominant and scary, you will dominate and people will be scared of you. And it has worked beautifully for Andrew Cuomo for a very long time. And that's sort of what I mean by the theatrics of dominance.
There is another narrative about him, though, that says the fact that that he had this domineering personality helped him get things done at a policy level, whether it was on-time state budgets or tough-to-pass legislation that they're flailing away at and failing at in Washington, you know, marriage equality before the Supreme Court, gun control after Newtown, like exactly what they wanted at in Washington and have never gotten, banning fracking, $15 minimum wage, that it's his use of power, maybe even compared to his father, that helped get these things done. I can remember somebody was running for president. I wish I could remember who it was in one of the recent primaries. And people said, oh, he's too nice. He's a nice guy, but he won't be an effective executive. So I guess I'm wondering, is there a sweet spot? Is a sweet spot ever possible where somebody really has power, exercises power, but for whom it doesn't fall over into abuse?
Yeah, well, I think that when we accept the framing that whatever Cuomo's achievements as governor are, and we can sort of debate where he came to those issues, because I think a lot of people who've worked on them for decades would say that those a lot of that legislation he actually got to pretty late. And in fact, in some cases, worked perhaps behind the scenes to obstruct until it finally became a reality, and he did it. Those we would have to go issue by issue, but I will say that to absorb that narrative, like he got things done, is to absorb something to accept a framework that we have simply been taught from birth, which is that politics is a hard knuckled game, and you gotta be tough. And keep in mind that all of this is very tied up with ideas about masculinity, and particularly white masculinity, right? Mm-hmm. And that all of this happens within, a white patriarchy, a white capitalist patriarchy. But I think Cuomo is a test case for like, wait, can we try to disentangle our ideas about what effective power is? That it doesn't have to be mean, threatening, and scary necessarily. We see somebody who's a bully and very effective at intimidating people and say, wow, well, they really get the job done. And it feeds into ideas that we associate that's what power is to us, is somebody who's tough and mean. And I don't know that that has to be the case. And I think we have to step back and question that. And the Cuomo administration is a sort of test case for this. When I was reporting in the spring again and again, you're right, there are these competing narratives. But again and again, we find that some of the things that he effectively touted as being his achievements were either the achievements of a lot of other people who he wasn't necessarily working to support as they were doing this work, mm-hmm. or B, that in fact some of that stuff winds up being empty, and that he wasn't getting through all kinds of policy and legislation protections that New York could have been getting through. And that, again, this goes back to very old ideas about if you want to be appreciated as a leader, you have to be tough. And I think we have to really retrain our brains to disentangle the idea of effective leadership, or even really toughness, right? What does toughness mean? Is it somebody you can count on, somebody who is honest and straightforward, who takes a firm moral line? Or is it somebody who is willing to scare people in his administration, state employees, journalists, in order to preserve an image of himself, right? And that's, I think, much closer to what Cuomo was. And it speaks to our own, the ways we've been taught to understand power, that we could so easily accept that as like, well, he's hard-knuckled and he's our bully, and say that's what good leadership is. I actually think we need to question those assumptions.
What do you think his resignation means for the Me Too movement, if we can use that phrase, or for gender equity in the workplace overall?
Well, I think it's obviously very tied to these broader stories about a movement toward greater gender equality. But I think, like so much of what we've seen happen that's been explosive and monumental over these past few years, I think it is one data point, right? And I think that we're too quick to say, see, here's the end of the story. This is what happened. And look at what Me Too wrought. It's really nothing about this is simple. And the story of pushing toward greater gender equality happens over years, over decades, over centuries, right? And so I do think, obviously, part of how we get here is, you know, through the explosion of the hashtag Me Too movement, which of course is distinct in another iteration of Tarana Burke's Me Too movement, but the hashtag Me Too movement that erupts in the fall of 2017 and that prompts a tremendous global reckoning around power, sexualized power abuse. I think it's really important to note that of the 11 women that Attorney General Tish James's report covers, more than half of them experienced the harassment that they say they experienced at the hands of Governor Cuomo after November of 2017, right? So that clip you played of him in 2018 saying we don't accept, this is after the reporting on Harvey Weinstein, after the hashtag MeToo movement has erupted, that Cuomo is still behaving this way. As we know, Charlotte Bennett alleges that this was happening in the midst of COVID just last year, her interactions with him, right? So, and I think I want to note that in particular because we do all have a tendency to say, well, see, now we all know better, right? Now we've learned and behavior is going to change. Even Cuomo in his defenses initially last week was talking about this is a generational thing. I don't know any better. I was raised in it. There are generational changes, you know, no generational change. He was talking in 2018 in that clip you just played about ending sexual harassment. And he was asking his young staffer, Charlotte Bennett, about dating older men and inappropriate questions about her sex life in 2020. So again, I just always want to be careful about claiming that we're any closer to the end of a story. We are so in the midst of these conversations and really our ongoing wrestling match with inequality, sexualized inequality, gender inequality, racial inequality, and actually broader inequalities around power and its abuses that I think are also really important and absolutely tied to the more sexualized stories that were at the heart of the Attorney General's report. Cuomo's abuses of power extend beyond simply the sexualized harassment.
Let me play the clip of Cuomo yesterday in his resignation speech that you just referred to, in which he refers to generational change.
In my mind, I've never crossed the line with anyone. But I didn't realize the extent to which the line has been redrawn. There are generational and cultural shifts that I just didn't fully appreciate. And I should have. No excuses.
So I guess in a way, the easy question is, how much do you buy that line versus some of the evidence, like on the plane one time with Lindsay Boylan, he said, let's play strip poker, you know, which I don't think the Me Too movement had to break out in 2017 for a male boss to know is an inappropriate joke with a much younger woman employee. There was a witness to that who testified to the Attorney General. Her direct supervisor was also on the plane and said, yep, I heard that. So that's one question. But more broadly, how much do you think there is a generational change that is bringing more equity to the workplace?
So I want to say this really clearly. When Andrew Cuomo talks about being generationally confused and new standards being applied and he's just a 63-year-old guy, okay, I want to be really clear. He's lying. Because in 1986, the Supreme Court ruled unanimously that sexual harassment in the workplace was illegal under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. Andrew Cuomo was in his 20s. He was just out of law school. In 1991... when Anita Hill testified against Clarence Thomas and described all of the ways in which Clarence Thomas had sexually harassed her when they worked together, He was in his early 30s. And again, it was just 4 years ago that the entire planet experienced an explosive reckoning around sexual assault and harassment. So when he says he's confused, he's telling a lie to cover for himself.
But I'm sure he would say that the Anita Hill story, for example, those allegations, which were, you know, really gross ways of coming on to her by Clarence Thomas, allegedly, and the fact that he continued to come on to her after she rejected him, Cuomo would say, no, this is not anything like that. I was just being playful, and I wasn't actually coming on to people in the instances that he's referring to.
I think that, well, the instances that he's referring to, he's picking very specific instances. There are multiple women who have described him asking inappropriate questions about their sex lives, their love lives, their marriages, their preferences. There are also, of course, women who allege that he has kissed them, again, asking to play strip poker. There is a woman who alleges that he groped her breast, that he looked down her shirt in a very obvious way and commented on her necklace. These behaviors, and especially as a pattern, I am sure he would say this was different. And let me get to the next point. Once I say that that he is lying about not knowing that these things are inappropriate or illegal, I will also say that where he has ground to stand on is that despite the fact that these behaviors have been prohibited for as long as they have been, they have still been treated as normal. And somehow, often, for powerful men, attached to our understandings of them as powerful men. And Cuomo has benefited from that. He is correct when he says, in his own defense, I kiss people in front of cameras all the time. He's right. He does. There is video that resurfaced last spring of him making an absolutely inappropriate remark on camera to a reporter in front of a lot of people. She was eating a sausage sandwich, and he said, come over and have, you know, but that we'll take a selfie. Oh, there's too much sausage in this picture. It's a disgusting thing you don't say in a professional circumstance, especially to a young female reporter. You don't say it. He did it in front of cameras. And there's a way in which, like the broader bullying itself, this speaks to the way that even as we fight to get closer to understanding how sexualized power abuse and other forms of power abuse are discriminatory, do systemic harm to broad classes of people, even as we get better vocabulary and understanding, we still, as a culture and society, normalize those behaviors. It was just Cuomo being Cuomo. Like, it was just Harvey being Harvey. It was no secret ever that Harvey Weinstein was a brutal bully. But all those behaviors, and we see that with so many of the people who we since have learned about more terrible things that they did, there was just this assumption that's just Harvey being Harvey, Andrew being Andrew. That's what power looks like. It is abusive. It's scary. It takes what it wants. We have been trained, again, since birth, to kind of admire that and associate it with effectiveness. And so in that regard, while he is simply not being truthful about not knowing these things about what he's allowed to do or not allowed to do because of generational change. He is also being honest about the fact that he's done them for his whole life and that only now is he being called out on them. They have been normalized. They've been part of his shtick and thus his, again, theatrical appeal.
Listener writes on Twitter, I hope Ryan Lehrer discusses with Rebecca Traister what it looks like when our supposed closest allies, in fact, work behind the scenes to harm us most, like Roberta Kaplan and Tina Chen did with Cuomo. We can't report if we can't trust anyone. And for people who don't know these names, I'll just say about Roberta Kaplan. She was a leader in the Time's Up organization, which is related to the Me Too movement. But she resigned from that the other day because apparently she was helping the Cuomo team behind the scenes to, you know, cover their image around this. So what do you say to this listener, to this listener's question and the premise we can't report if we can't trust anyone?
This is one of the horrors of reporting on power and its abuses, is that very often we wind up looking, and I'm speaking very broadly here, and this is one of the incredibly hard things about the kinds of reckonings we've been having around around gendered and racist power abuses, is that it often means looking at our allies. It means looking at ourselves. And again, this process that we're in the midst of understanding how many of us are implicated in and benefit from these grave and harmful inequities that have left certain kinds of people at the top of all kinds of power structures, economic, political, social, sexual. And the thing that makes it hard, the thing that makes people want to brush it off and just go back to where we were, you know, is that entails looking and understanding and rooting out the ways in which our allies, the people that we have been dependent on and trusted, have also benefited from the very inequities that perhaps they're supposed to be fighting. And the Time's Up story is tremendously sad. The revelations about Robbie Kaplan having signed off on Cuomo's attempt to disparage one of his accusers, Lindsay Boylan, are just gutting. But this is also what it means when we look at some of the political leaders besides, when we look at Eric Schneiderman, you know, and understand that Schneiderman was also understood to be, you know, a great progressive fighter and an ally. It's what it means when we talk about the women who described their experiences with Al Franken. And I know that that will, you know, prompt 100 people to call and say that Franken was wronged. However, part of that is because it's really hard to take a look at the ways that the people we depend on to be our champions and our allies and to be alongside us. I mean, this is the pain and the difficulty of the process. But if we don't do it, we're not going to move anywhere better. If we just take it as like, well, they're our friend, that's not going to get us anywhere better.
There we leave it with Rebecca Traister, writer-at-large for New York Magazine and the author of Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.